Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Virgil Films. With over 25 years of distribution experience, Virgil has released such hits as Super Size Me and the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, along with a trove of indie treasures like Forks Over Knives, To Die For, 7 Yards, and Speed is Expensive. Now, you can find all of those films, along with the entire Virgil catalog, on any transactional platform out there, like Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, Tubi, and the rest. Are you a filmmaker and you're having trouble with distribution? Talk to Virgil. They work with every major platform directly, and they offer a variety of deals that fit with every filmmaker's needs, from standard distribution to service deals. They do it all. And they don't just distribute films, they elevate them. Truthfully, they're just really good people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com and tell them Christian Taylor sent you. And now, on with the show. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Documentary First, where we have an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host, Christian Taylor, and a documentary filmmaker myself. I'm sitting down with storytellers who capture real life stories one frame at a time so that we can become better filmmakers. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Jeffrey Ross. He's a director, and he is coming here to talk to us about his debut feature. It's coming up, A Man with the Hat, being distributed by Virgil Films, our very own sponsor, as well as my distributor, amazing people over there at Virgil Films. His first debut feature, The Wonder of It All, is an award-winning, critically acclaimed documentary that captures the human side of the Apollo astronauts. He went on to direct 41 for HBO, an intimate 3-year portrait of President George H.W. Bush, executive produced by Jerry Weintraub. His CNN film, President in Waiting, brings together every living president and vice president to explore how the vice presidency evolved from a ceremonial role into one of the most powerful offices in the world. Jeffrey's latest project, The Man with the Hat, is a cinematic journey with the world's famous Egyptologist, Dr. Zahi Hawass, taking us back 4,000 years into tombs and temples, and never before seen discoveries in Egypt. Jeffrey, welcome to Documentary First.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So you asked me if I had seen the movie last night, and I was very reserved because I didn't really want to tell you, and I didn't really want to say what I thought. But yes, I did see it. I was incredibly impressed. It was beautifully cinematically shot. It was very moving. It was unusual because, and this is what I want to talk about, it was completely character driven by Dr. Hawass. No narration, really. It was just no talking heads. It was completely character driven, as, I mean, he's a big character, so he can carry that, you know, a film. And to me, it seemed like it must have been something incredibly challenging to film. And
true.
I have so many questions about how you were able to pull that off. I can't imagine you have this huge studio that's backing you and all of these, you know, things at your disposal. So tell me how in the world you were able to pull off this unbelievable magic.
Okay, so where to start? As you've kind of alluded to, it's basically Zahi telling his own story. And that's the style that I like to do as a filmmaker. And if you look at any of my movies, it's always the living person. And so right. when I was trying to figure out what to do next, you know, you go through the names and you kind of sit with things for a while. And then it's like, okay, well, 2 days later, maybe it didn't sound so good. So, you know, you go through that kind of a journey. And then it's like, once you land on something, you got to find them, see if they're interested. Because if they're not interested in telling their story, then it's over. So,
well, and let me stop you right there for a second. So what you're saying is, as a filmmaker, and I was going to ask you this later, because the other thing I wanted to tell you is after I watched that, I was like, let me look for about 20 minutes at 41. Because it was late. Like it was about, I think, 10 o'clock when I finished. And I was like, oh, I'm tired, but let me look at 20 minutes at 41. I couldn't just look at 20 minutes. I watched the whole 110 and I got super sucked in. I really loved it. And then I was going to watch the other ones, and I was like, I can't, I got to go to bed. And, but you know, what I did notice was that theme of you picking, you know, individual people and letting them tell their story. So that is something you've decided to be your way of telling stories, and you go and just look for individuals that you're interested in. You ask them if they want to tell your story, and then you like develop a relationship like a writer does with a book, a biographer kind of thing. And you make that relationship. Is that what you do?
Sort of, but you also go with whatever, however they want to handle it. Right. So when you look at the astronaut movie or the vice president one, I was dealing with multiple people there. And sometimes, you know, especially with presidents or vice presidents, you're dealing with their schedules. So you don't have time to work really with anybody. You got to do it all kind of yourself. You show up, you do it, and off you go. With Dr. Hawass, you know, I just kind of emailed him through a website because, you know, he's in Egypt. Like, okay, how do I find this guy? And then you think like, okay, you know, how do you get through the layers of people to get to the person? So you very simply send an email out that said, hey, you know, I'm kind of interested in doing a documentary. Please put me in touch with the right people. And like within an hour, I got a email right back from him, said basically, meet me in Salt Lake City next week.
Wow.
Okay. So, you know, a week later, and this was mid-December in 22, and meet him at a hotel. And within 10 minutes, he says, give me your pad of paper. He's like, okay, we're going to go here, and this is what you need to do. And you're going to come to Egypt in February. And, you know, now I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, here we are almost at the end of December. And he's basically telling me to be there in February because you got to work around his schedule. And then that's where the problems started, because once you go off that cliff, it's a challenge, but it's a fascinating challenge, right? And
well,
you do it because
you have the money. When somebody says, okay, you're going to start shooting in February. I mean, how did you have time to raise the money to start shooting?
Well, we generally do the funding ourselves, being independent. For me, to go through the route of trying to find people to, you know, whether to sell it to a studio or a network, or whether to go for funding, like say, it's a long process. And that's something that I didn't want to do. And also, what I kind of like about this being low budget, but also doing it on your own, is that you don't have anybody over your shoulder telling you what to do. And so there's a satisfaction, of course, with that. So whenever I do a talk or anything, I just say, listen, I don't care if you like the movie or not, right? Just appreciate what we did with, you know, a very small crew, very small amount of money, and we're able to produce something like this. So that when he basically says, yeah, be in Egypt in February, we could. So I wasn't scrambling for that. You're more or less scrambling to get all of your, find the fixer. You got to find
paperwork,
everything, the crew over there. And then you very quickly learn what you can and can't do.
All right. So do you mind me asking what your budget was? Did you set up a budget beforehand? Did you have the whole movie planned out? Or did you think, okay, I'm going to do this as it goes, one thing at a time? I mean, clearly you went to all the big places where the tombs were, all the cities, plus you went to where he grew up. And so you definitely had all these different locations. They were at different times. So you had several trips over there to Egypt. I saw either you went after COVID, but still there were masks being worn. So there was still some fears there. And then, you know, I'm sure, you know, if you're working, hiring local crew, you know, you've got permissions for things. I mean, there's paperwork and governmental red tape. There's, you know, it's expensive to get equipment if you're not flying it over there. I mean, what did you decide to do about all of that? It's a lot of questions. Okay. I just threw at you.
Right. So let me try to go backwards on those. So the first thing you have to do is you have to get your fixer. You cannot just show up at Egypt's door and say, I want to shoot a movie. They won't look at you, talk to you. You got to start with that. And then from that, the first step that you do is you have to write a letter to the Egyptian embassy in Washington, D.C., who then forwards your request on into Egypt to the ministries. while you're doing that and waiting for those permissions to come through, you're trying to figure out, you know, locations. Where are things? How far is it from this place to that place? So you can figure out your days. And then once you get all that, they tell you, or they they advise you, you don't bring a lot of crew, hire local, and don't bring a lot of gear. Because the one thing that they do or make you do is to provide a serial number for every piece of equipment that you bring into the country. Wow. So, you know, and then it's like, okay, fine. But do you guys have gear that matches up with what we have or that we want to use? And then you find that their names of what they call things are different. Their film language is different. Mm. And then like, you can't just go interview crew, right? They just kind of, again, everything is through the fixer. And so they just show up, and then you got to worry about the language barrier. And even if they do speak English, you know, sometimes the accents get in the way, whether it's me talking or them talking. And also when you've got a finite time to shoot, because a lot of times they will give you permissions, but it may be only for an hour if they got to open up something special for you. So now you show up and you've got to go, okay, no matter what you want to plan, if you've never been to a place before, you got to figure all that out within an hour.
Right, because you weren't able to scout.
Correct. Wow. So you got.
And you were going into tombs. I mean, the things that I thought were nuts is that he was going down into, you know, tunnels. They're not tunnels. They're
shafts or tombs.
Shafts down into the tombs to see a sarcophagus open for the first time. And you guys were in there seeing what he was seeing for the first time. I mean, how amazing.
Literally is mind blowing, because, you know, you want to make movies and you want to do things, but then you realize over there, no, this is real. I mean, and you're in places that you never thought you would be, let alone rolling cameras or calling action or whatever you're doing.
Well, and that's what I was so amazed about your film, because I have always loved Egypt history, right? And archaeology. I actually took some classes in that in college. And going to a museum is one thing, but when you're in a museum and you're seeing all this stuff, I've always wondered what it was like at those first discoveries, when they first found them, or when they opened the tomb, or what's it like in there? And you want to peer it just like he does. I mean, he wants to be at every one that's first open. You can tell they don't open it until they call him. I know it. And so you can see them like, okay, we found this, stop. We have to call Dr. Hawass. So for you to have that kind of access, that was crazy. And you had at least two of those. Did you have more? Two made it into the film.
I would say we had two, and we had some really small things that, you know, we don't call out that they're first discoveries or never before seen or whatever you want to say, because we wanted more of the beauty to stand out, right? And sometimes just because they make a discovery doesn't necessarily mean it's going to make it to the public, because historically it may not be a big deal. But
it's a big deal. What I think is what he's doing now is he's capturing their own history for them. It's not like it's, hey, look, this is the richest king ever. It's that there's still so much of civilization that's lying under their feet, and they're careful about their ancestors and their history, and they're wanting to discover it. And they care about the simple man. I mean, there was a family that they uncovered, one of the powerful moments in the film. I loved this. I loved how you showed this family that they uncovered, and how they were gently uncovering these mummies that were lying just open in the dirt, and how he went to see them and then said, don't dig them up, cover them up. That was so tender. And you guys had taken a picture and put it over a canvas and showed it to him, and he cherished it. And he said he didn't have anything like that, and then he loved it and wanted it. And then I think shortly after that, you cut to him playing with his granddaughter and his granddaughter's hat. And oh my goodness, that scene was just so precious, and how much that relationship you could see, you know, just them playing together. And It was just so, you could see how much he loved his people and he cherished what he was doing. And it did demonstrate, you know, you showed in the letters, and I liked that you did this. There was always talk about how he was, there were people trying to tear him down and to show how what he was doing was for show or he was corrupt. I've heard all those stories, but he's continued to press on and persevere and be this larger than life figure. And I liked it that you did show him those quotes and give him an opportunity to respond. And what you also did, though, was, and this is what I tried to do in my own life, you can say your words about what you believe and who you think you are. But in a sense, that doesn't matter. What matters is how you live. And what I think you demonstrated was how he lived, right? You showed it in that interaction with his granddaughter. You showed it as he would walk through the city and anywhere he was and stop with the people and take pictures with them or shake their hands. Always, whether he was eating or whether he was going into his home, you could see the patience and how he realized that he represented something bigger than himself and he cared about that. So he lived what he said he believed. And when you opened with talking about his father, I was already in tears from the opening, just because I'm sorry, I can't believe I'm getting emotional. You could tell how impactful his father's words were to him and how he took those to heart. I think his father died when he was 13. So his father, when he was a young boy, implanted those words in him and it set him on a course for the rest of his life that has changed the history of Egypt. And he gives his father, who died when he was 13, complete credit for who he is. It was remarkable to me, you know, and I think as parents, we would all want to have that kind of influence on our kids, you know? And so I loved that you opened with that moment because, like I said, I think his life demonstrated that he was living what he said he believed. And as you can tell, I really felt like that was a lot of the beauty of your movie. It started off very powerfully for me, and it was the beauty of the landscape and the music, the score amplified that. And then just his storytelling of how much he cared about what he was doing. You guys were able to really demonstrate that through the story. And I can imagine in the editing, that must have been hard for you to figure out that story part.
Yes. And I'll say this, look, I can relate with him more than you probably know because I lost my parents when I was 18. So you're going to get me going, but
I just lost my mother. So I think that's why I'm emotional as well. It's a very tough thing. I don't think it matters how old you are.
No, that's for sure. But I felt that Zahi is, as you've seen and you kind of mentioned and alluded to, they don't come any bigger than him from Egypt, right? And people want to tear him down. I think anybody in any profession that gets to a certain elevation in your career, that's the name of the game, is to bring you down.
Yeah.
So very early on in the movie, which obviously you saw, that was our way of letting you understand that this movie is going to be different. We do open with obviously shots of ancient Egypt and get there, but we also make a complete turn where he does talk about his influence, and that theme does come throughout the movie.
Well, and you can tell that he doesn't care about his influence for his influence sake. What he cares about is what his influence hopefully is doing for Egypt's sake. And that's a very different thing. You know, I think he says at some point he wanted to be an actor when he was younger. And it's funny how he talks about his tribulations all throughout his life and including being a bad student and wanting to go in different directions and, you know, not succeeding in any of those ways and not even wanting to go into archaeology and just keep, you know, getting forced into this way by life. Right. And at any rate, finding his calling found him, and he has, you know, grown into where he is, and those desires and things that he wanted to be all came together to serve Egypt. And even like you said, once you get to that certain level anywhere, people begin to turn you down, tear you down. But he said, even through that tribulation, you know, he said, I'm trying to remember what was so powerful. It was something like, it escaped my mind. One thing he said was that, you know, it was that just he had to go through that and continue on and not let any of that tear him down or stop him. Or he knew that you can't judge a book by its cover. That was it. That it was wrong to believe something about a person before you knew them. And he was so certain in who he was. His identity in himself and who he was so strong. He knew he wasn't corrupt. He knew he wasn't doing things wrong. And so it did not matter what people said about him. He was going to just soldier on, right?
Right. And look, a few things are, A, he's a character. He has separated himself from the pack. He definitely has an ego, mm-hmm. as most people do. But I think, yes, there is that soft side of him, which is very difficult to get out. But you do hear it in him in the movie, where he is talking about he wants to educate the kids. He wants to do it for the Egyptian people. He wants the Egyptian people to be proud of their history. Because mm-hmm. throughout time, other people have come into Egypt to take things out of Egypt.
And I tell you, you made me mad. By the time you got to the place where I realized, where you explained, this was really good that you did this, or he did this, how France had cut, Napoleon had come in there and drawn everything, which was good, but then took the things out of Egypt. And, but then you showed me the, I forget what the place is, the, where the obelisk is missing.
Luxor Temple.
The Luxor Temple. And I really didn't understand, except that I've been to Paris. I didn't know what that was, but now I know where it is. And I remember it being there. And now I see where it's missing. And I see from the faraway vantage that you showed me, it feels like it was raped and it belongs there. It's horrible that it's not there because it's a pear. It's part of a pear. And now the opening of that looks terrible. And I can see where he's upset and he wants his things returned.
I think
so. That made me angry.
Yeah. And I think if you really dig into it, I mean, no pun intended there, but I believe the number is Italy, I believe, has 9 of them. And there's other countries that have more, and they're not reproductions. They came from Egypt. And so he is trying to get some things back. He does feel that there is a place for all museums around the world to have these artifacts so people can go see and learn. But the bigger ones is the ones that he would like to see back in their homeland.
Yeah. And I think there are reasons for this, where they're missing and they should be there. And they could also be loaned out and travel around like the Cleopatra or whatever. But there are things that should be in Egypt that were taken wrongly. And he has reasons for that. And they make sense. You know, you talked about him being a character and larger than life. And I'm wondering, when you select a character like that, is it difficult to work with them? And what challenges does that present?
Let's just say you could be there showing up on site for the first time with him. He could be in the car ahead of you. You show up, you've got your crew, you got the vans, you got gear, you got everything you need. You don't even have 2 feet out of the car and he's looking at you like, you ready to shoot? It's like, we just got here with you. You know, we'd like to just look around for a moment here. So there's that. You have to hang on with him, because I think when we shot, he was 76, 77.
Ooh.
And he is like the Energizer Bunny. He just goes and goes. And then that's part of the thing, like in the movie, like he's always moving in the movie, right? Yeah. And we wanted to show that. Yeah. He's everywhere. But that is a true thing. He will get up in the morning, get on a flight, fly down to Luxor from Cairo, do his things down there, meet tour groups and things like that. And then that night, he's on a flight back home at 11. Next day in the morning at 5, he's up again. Now he's in Cairo somewhere dealing with other people. And it just repeats and repeats and repeats. This past summer, he was on a tour here in the United States. He did 32 cities in 60 days for an hour and a half lecture. And he's bringing in about 2,000-3,000 people a night. And he just goes. But, and you kind of got to hang on. But yes, but to deal with him from a directing point of view, you have to give him his space and do what he wants to do. And I'm not saying this is not a bad thing at all, because I do this in anybody that I've dealt with. But then you try to figure out how to get what is it that you're looking for. Right? Yeah. He knows, and he has things in his head that he has said thousands of times when you show up at a site. When he says that, it's like, okay, and sometimes that could be good, sometimes not. And then sometimes you got to go, okay, now what about this? Because now I got to guide him into what I'm looking for. And he doesn't know necessarily, because how can you? How can anybody? Until you see it at the end, right? Sometimes we're guessing too, until we get into the edit room, see what works or what doesn't work. So, yeah. But he's definitely a fun guy to deal with.
I found that out with veterans, who are 102, they have told their story so many times. They are in this mode of telling their story. If you have other questions or you want to learn other things, they have to stop and think about that. That takes a different part of their brain and a different track usually, and they're not accustomed to that. And so it does take them time, and you're asking them for a different skill set, really. And so, I've experienced that. It's a different thing for them to do.
But I think sometimes that's also good to show, especially if it's on camera, that you put in your film, because it lets the audience know that they are thinking about it, mm-hmm. that it is a moment of maybe just quiet, but they're formulating something that is just different to them. Mm-hmm. And I like that.
I like that too. And I like that you did ask him, you did ask him questions that you would not hear in any talk that he went to, which, developed more who he was as a person and what motivated him to do what he does. And like you said, at the end, the images of the children with the children, he's just so tender. And you can see how he cares about the future of Egypt and carrying on those legacies. If he doesn't find people that care about it as passionately as he does, it will not carry on. And he knows that. So I think that was great to show. What were some other difficulties and challenges? Did the fixer was, I know it was important for finding crew or equipment. And what else did the fixer do that was so critical? And was it as helpful as you had hoped?
Well, I mean, it's everything from the moment that you arrive in Egypt to getting your visa, to giving you the transportation, to the hotels, from getting you from point A to point B, having all the permits ready to go, having the crew, their vehicles, getting them to their hotels. I mean, really anything here that we would do, but they do it all.
And that kind of... How much did that cost? How much does a fixer cost?
I'll say this. To put a number on it can be a little difficult in the sense that, I don't generally like to give out the numbers per se, but everything was pretty much fair. And I'll say it this way, whereas whatever you were going to pay, crew, hotel, this, that, the other, they just, I think, tacked on basically a 15%, and that was their fee.
Okay.
So, for basically 15%, you're getting the logistics done, even though you'd still have to pay a hotel if you show up, right? So I thought that was fair. I never thought anything that we were charged was out of line.
So they didn't get paid by the hour, or they weren't paid by in a lump sum. They were paid percentage based on what you paid other people.
Or things, whether they would bring lunch in, right? So let's just say the bill for lunch was, $300. They 15% on top of that.
I see.
But, and then they were more, I'd say everything over there worked more on flats. Nobody was really by the hour. It was either by the day or like the car service was by day, wasn't by, you know, okay, if you only take it 4 hours, we'll charge you this. If it's eight, we'll charge you that. So everything was reasonable.
And do you have a budget that you know that you've spent on this film?
I do.
Can you share?
I prefer not.
Okay.
I prefer not to, only because then, you know, if anybody was ever looking to figure out what we spent in order to try to make a deal with me, and I mean more of like some kind of a streamer or a second deal somewhere down the line, they use that against you. So I don't want to go there. It's not that I don't want to say, it's just, I'm just trying to protect what we have.
No, I understand. I understand. Yeah. Well, some people feel that way. Sure.
You know, the goal also is that, you know, look, and I'm just saying that it's not a lot of money in the scheme of things, right? We don't have that. And so we have to fit within a budget, and we also have to make the movie look like we spend a lot more than what we spend.
Right. Sure.
So, I think I would, you know, visually, I would put this movie up against any documentary of Egypt.
Yeah, I would agree.
And most people that do films in Egypt are the streamers or the networks or.
And yeah, I could see this on any travel channel. I could see it on the History Channel, and I could see it fit right there. Absolutely.
Yeah, and Zahi has always been the guy. You know, if you know of Zahi, he's the guy that always took you from the studio side of things to the antiquity side of things. He was always the middleman, right? Because of his character, the showmanship and all that stuff. So we were just trying to do something a little different and present him along with the antiquities and make it more a film than a TV show.
Right. Well, has he seen the finished product?
Yes.
And what was it?
He's a man of few words, but really? I'll say that. I do.
Imagine that.
You've seen him in the movie, so you know he's got no problem telling you what he thinks about anything.
Right.
So I knew the one good news is that when he saw it, we were kind of with maybe 30 or 40 people in the theater. And I knew if he was going to take me out, it wasn't going to be in that moment because there's other people around, right? So he was going to be respectful. But it was in when I was driving with him the next day for about an hour, I thought, okay, he's going to do it now. But he didn't. And along the way, he had us. Now, if I can go back to the point where you're saying that it's about him and I don't bring in other people. And I kept telling him from the moment that I met him to the moment that we were shooting that I want this to be about you in your words and things like that. Yet everywhere we would go, he would say, okay, interview this person about me. Interview this person. And so out of respect, we did. And when we got in the editing, of course, you know, we didn't use it. And the first thing he said to me after the screening is he comes up to me and he says, Jeff, you didn't use any of the interviews. And I said, did you miss them? And he said, no. And he left me alone. So, because I knew what I was trying to do. Right. And I think it was different for him, for somebody to say that, because he's used to things with other people. And so I was just trying to
do. Actually, my guess is it might have been, it's always better to hear what other people are saying about us than hearing what we say about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe there was an element of that he would rather see a movie where other people are talking about him than him talking about himself. It's probably a little bit uncomfortable.
It is, but he's used to that. And I've had people that have seen it, that have known him, worked with him 30 years, 40 years. And they didn't know he had a granddaughter. They didn't know the names of his kids.
Really?
They didn't know the name of his wife. And so when they see this, they're like, oh my God, you know, to see him in a tender moment from somebody that's known him for 30 or 40 years as the guy that you probably assume that he is. It was a little different for these people to see him in that light.
Yeah. Yeah. I love seeing the pictures of his family and hearing all of that background and about school. And it was just really nice.
And it's hard to find pictures from Egypt from the 1940s and 50s.
Yeah.
they didn't save a lot of things back then.
I bet. I want to move on to lessons for documentary filmmakers who might be tempted to just, you know, use one person like that, or they might be tempted to use a voiceover, a guiding voiceover. What did you learn leaning so heavily on one character?
Okay, so you obviously have to have a way that you're going to ask your questions and what you're going to cut to formulate the story, because you do have only one voice. And so there's really no, when I mean cut away, I mean to another voice, right? You can cut away to a different, like a transition or something different, but it all goes to the questions. It all goes, in all reality, it goes to his answers too.
And I have a perfect example. Let me see if this is what you're talking about. He's talking about something about where he almost was bit by a cobra. And you bring out Abbott or Costello, which one is he? And he's playing
in trouble.
He's playing the little flute thingy that you would play in Egypt, where the cobra comes up out of the basket and he can't see it. And then he stops playing, he puts his hat on the basket, plays again, and he sees the hat come up, and then he sees the cobra, and then he runs away. And that's exactly what, you know, Zahi was talking about, how he stood real still because cobras are blind and they can't see. And then when he went back down, he ran away, right?
Right. And then, because also, how do you take that story, tell it by itself, and make it entertaining?
Right.
Right. So you try to expand it, you try to put things in, because you're doing storytelling and not making a PowerPoint presentation.
Right.
So if I could also give you one other way for us, which was not so much the words, but what happened that you can never plan on, which is, if you go to that photo that you saw of the five mummies. So the first shoot that we did, we were not even supposed to see that, be anywhere near that. So we were shooting in Saqqara, and somebody, a local person, comes up and points down there and says, "Mummies." And we're like, "Mummies, where?" Well, of course, we're like, "Where?" And they said, "No, down there." And we're looking, we don't see them. So I finally went to the guy that was with us, and I said, "Can we go down there?" And I said, "Listen, I promise I won't bring the cameras. We're just curious." And he says, "Sure." So we go down, and sure enough, there they were, the five mummies, right? And then somebody said, "Do you want to bring cameras down?" I said, "Yes." So we go down and we do that scene. But meanwhile, we take the photo. So now Zahi comes to LA a couple months later, and we do the main interview with him, the sit down. And I blew that up to take to that interview to show him and piece this kind of together. And what you see in there when he says, "Did you take this? Send me a copy because I don't have one." That was a real moment. And we did make a copy for him. So he was back a couple months later, and I am here in LA and said, "Here, enjoy it." And he says, no, "I can't take it. Bring it with you when you come to Egypt," because we were going back for the second trip in October. And I said, okay. I don't want to, but I take it for him. And then we were trying to figure out the day to give it to him. And it turned out that the day that we gave it to him was literally the day that Jenna, his granddaughter, was there. So now this is where the magic of this organic process.
Remember, right. It was at the same time.
Yes. And so you find these things that you can never plan on, in my mind, that become great moments in movies. That thread from the original Saqqara, seeing the five mummies, to giving him the photo, to taking the photo to Egypt, we never planned it that way, nor could we. But it just worked. And so that's, again, these moments that you find where you're trying to do somebody by themselves to make something entertaining, because a lot of times, you know, the dialogue just keeps going, and you got to just, okay, how do we get a break from him? Because nobody's going to want to listen to somebody talk for 10 minutes in a row.
Yeah.
It just, right? So what do? You got to interweave. That's what we were trying to do. And everywhere that we did take him, if you've noticed, is not like, okay, let's show up here and let's do a history lesson on King Tut. It's places that he was connected to and that he could talk about. So it wasn't just taking you anywhere for any reason other than it's part of his story. And then, of course, we were there. I don't know if you saw, but we were there on when October 7th happened. We were shooting.
I didn't put that together.
We were in northern Egypt. And I think when we mapped it out, we were about 140 miles from Gaza on October 7th, shooting with him. And then, oh my God, that's where the problems really start. Because now hindsight is great. We're here a couple of years later. We understand it didn't really spread into Egypt or anything. But at that time, nobody knows what's going on. And so we had crew that went home. We had to figure out what to do, where can we shoot. They were concerned kind of for us that, like, okay, because, you know, when you're shooting with a film crew, you kind of stick out like a sore thumb. So we had to kind of figure things out. And you know, he wasn't in a good mood. And I don't mean that he was in a bad mood, but I think it really weighed on him. And then that affects what you're trying to get or what you see. And that day that you saw Jenna there, that's when he came really back to life for us, because that's his life. You see it.
Yeah.
And she's the sweetest thing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, and she just loved his hat, you know, and it was really neat because you then show about, you know, he tells about, you know, why he's called the man in the hat and the whole history of the hat and why the hat is so important. And, you know, it starts with, you know, Jenna telling, or him telling the story with Jenna. I thought that was a beautiful way that you wove that in there. It was just great.
It's kind of like it's like a Superman cape, you know, he's got like his character's outfit that once he puts on, he becomes that being of this Egyptologist that is larger than life.
Yeah. Now I want to move on, since we have a little bit of time left, to 41. You know, it was particularly special to me because my father was in the Reagan administration. I worked in Capitol Hill from the time I was 13 to the time I was 23, 24, something like that. And so I was there through the Reagan-Bush years and through the Bush-Cheney years. And this, it just reminded me of everything that I lived through. So it was fascinating. Of course, I've never been to Kennebunkport, and I wasn't inside. I only made it into the, you know, West Wing offices. I never went into the residence or anything like that. So it was, you know, you had incredible access. I'd love to know how you got all that access. And then I really would like to understand, you know, you committed years of your life to these subjects and what that's like. Access, how did you get that? What's it like committing your years of your life to telling stories about these people?
So 41, that came about from the wonder of it all, which was the astronaut, the guys that walked on the moon. There was a big screening at his library where we had, I believe it was six of the guys that walked on the moon, but overall we had eight Apollo astronauts in one place because he invited them. Did a big screening and dinner and all that stuff. And I walked out of there thinking, that was great. We'll never do that again. And then we got invited to Kennebunkport or Walker's Point, their property, to have lunch. And I was like, okay. And we showed the movie again there. And at that point, we had just finished The Wonder of It All. I was trying to figure out what to do next. So I asked his chief of staff. I said, is there any chance that he might be interested? And she's like, no. No. But out of respect and you coming up here, write him something and I'll send it his way. And I said, okay. But I said that I was headed to Australia because the State Department invited me out to show Wonder out there as like a cultural exchange. And I said, I'm going to be gone for a couple of weeks and I don't want to come back. She says, sure, no problem. But when I got back, landed, literally turned on the phone, there was an email from her, said, he's intrigued. And I said, okay. But I didn't do anything. And again, it was one of those things. That one, 6 weeks later, from that moment, we were in Kennebunkport shooting. Right? So it was quick. And having access with him was, I mean, humbling. It's fantastic. It's all these things that you could possibly imagine, because you're doing something that you never think that you would do, let alone making a movie about the guy. But he was very, very just easygoing. I'm sure you know this, right? He respected by a lot of people. And if I could tell you one story, which was towards the end of the shooting of that movie, President Obama was giving him the Presidential Medal of Freedom Award.
Yeah.
And that's in the movie. And I asked if we could shoot that. And they said, probably not, but we'll ask. I said, oh, okay. So it got back to us that the White House is allowing one person with one camera and no audio. So we had to do an onboard mic, and I was the camera guy, and we got his arrival. He comes in, goes into the China room, where at the time, and I don't know if they still do this, but at the time, each person that gets the award has to do an interview with the White House for historical purposes. And so, you know, I'm in there and I'm kind of at the side, and I don't want to let him know I'm there. I don't want anything. And he, at this point, he was in his wheelchair. And, you know, it's his day and all that stuff. But sure enough, he sees me. He points to his assistant to take me over there. He comes over to me and he says, how are you doing? And I was like, sir, this is your day. You know, you don't have to come over here. I'm just trying to be out of your way. But that's just the kind of guy that he was. You know, we spent, I'd say, just about 3 years on and off, of course.
What years were they?
That was 2009 through 2012.
And when did he pass?
Not that long. 2018 or 19, I believe.
Okay.
It was right before COVID.
I didn't think it was that long before he passed, actually. But he looked strong enough, so I knew it was several years before. But I also felt like it was during those years where he started getting very tender and where he was starting to share, you know, how emotional everything was making him, you know, about when he would talk about his family or when he would look back, because he was very vulnerable about those things, which made him all the more endearing to me, of course. But yeah, that was very powerful. I loved how you showed how he greeted the White House staff and how much the White House staff loved him. I thought that was really special.
Yeah, I tried to, you know, you've seen now, I like, if I can, to give a different take or a different look on somebody, right? So the whole goal here was to take politics out of it. And what is it? To me, the story is the man, it was about a man in his life who happened to become president. And then how do you show the person, also with the White House years, without going into detail about like policy or this, that, or the other, because somebody else either has made that movie or can make that movie. I was strictly more about him. And, you know, when you see those moments, those are just, it's him, right? Say the camera doesn't lie, but, and they came to him too, right? And he hadn't been there in how many years? So they respected him, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know.
And I love that they had not forgotten their names. Yeah. They knew their names. Like, you just could tell that relationship was there. So precious. How did you get him to be so open and relaxed on camera? Did you have to do anything, or was that just him? Because you're close up on him. He's still really relaxed every time you're talking to him, whether he's on the boat or whether he's, you know, in his office or whether he's driving a golf cart. He's very relaxed with you.
Yeah. The only thing I can say about that is, to me, I come as me, right? You've seen me do this now for, we've never met before, right?
Right.
But I am what I am, and this is it. I don't come in like, you know, with a suit, tie, hair all slicked up, very formal. I try to be relaxed, right? I try to be this, that, and the other. But at the same time, you kind of have to be calculated. You got to figure out like, okay, so if I can interview him for an hour and a half here at this setting, how do you start the interview to get him more to say things that you want and get him relaxed and then get into something else? But also, how do you bring somebody back down towards the end of the interview so they're not walking out of there that they hate you?
Right.
Because you need to come back and you want them to invite you back. Because, you know, when you're dealing with somebody of that status, he doesn't have to come back, right?
Right.
And I even asked him one time, I said, sir, of all the people in Hollywood that you could have had tell your story, why are you allowing me to do it? And he laughed and he just said, my chief of staff is making me do it. So I knew I was never going to get an answer, but I don't know.
One of the things that I thought was fascinating, you know, you stay away from politics always, really. The only time you hear any of it is when he starts to talk about his journey in politics. And even then, it's more about his journey in the jobs. It's not his political perspective per se, until he starts talking about the races that he had to run. And there's the one thing that was funny is when you asked him about Ross Perot, I think you asked him about. And he was absolutely adamant that he was not going to talk about Ross Perot. But even more, he said he didn't like him. And that is not George Bush.
And there's the one moment that he did not look relaxed, right?
He wasn't. He got very tense. And yes. You realize that if he was that tense on camera, can you imagine how angry or whatever it was he must really feel? I don't remember what it was, but it was not good. So, but what I did think was interesting is if you look back now, and I've seen a lot of footage actually from the Bush-Reagan years that are so diametrically opposed to what's happening in the Republican Party now. And I was listening to him talk about the CIA and how he had to go up to Capitol Hill and defend against people in Congress who were tearing down the CIA and what was happening in there, and how he had to go up there and defend the CIA and the people that were working there and the years of workers that had built up their reputations there. And he talked about that institutional knowledge and just their years of service. And you saw the respect for service workers, just like he saw it as if it was in the military, which it is, really, frankly. I'm glad he's not here to see what is happening. I mean, I just imagine his heart would be broken with what he feels like, you know, or what he said he felt like at that time and how strongly he felt about how that must be protected. And it was very shocking to me. I have felt in my soul, because that's kind of how I was raised, with sort of those thoughts as a Republican at the time. You know, I started feeling like, wait a second, I haven't changed. What's happened? And it's true. In a lot of ways, I haven't changed, but the Republican Party has changed. And I was able to see that clearly by hearing the president, who was a Republican, talk about what it was like at the time. So that was interesting, watching that now, just for me to have some perspective. So I appreciated that it wasn't political per se, but I was able to contrast then and now, and it gave me a little bit of perspective of sort of what I think I expect the American Revolution of Ken Burns film to be when I watch that. I'm looking forward to that coming out in a few days. And that reminds me, he must have inspired Ken Burns, some of your work, because there is his fingerprints in your work.
He liked, I would say so, in the fact that he tries to let people do the talking, even though they're not alive. Mm-hmm. Right. So whether I'm not sure who he's using now, but, you know, he was using Peter Coyote for a while.
He used Peter Coyote for American Revolution too.
Yeah. So to try to get you into a time that we cannot really fathom, for really any different subject, whether it's baseball, whether it's the Civil War or this, that, the other, we don't understand what it was like then, but somehow he can get the words from whatever person and bring it to life. To me, gives it that personal touch, which is something, yes, that I try to bring into my films, is the personal touch. Mm-hmm. And steer clear of the noise. And, you know, the Bush 41, it has nothing to do with how to like a Republican, how to hate a Republican. Right, it's a human interest story, And at the end of the day, you strip out all the Egyptian stuff, it's a human interest story. And the astronauts, sure, it's a human interest story, right? I'm not a science and technology guy with the Apollo program. I'm not a political insider. I'm definitely not an Egyptologist or an archaeologist. But I like to learn about people. And also with the fascination of those different topics, that's how my two things come together, you know. Now that it's only hindsight that you can look back and figure out, okay, why did I do this?
Yeah. Yeah. I share that characteristic. Actually, that's why you're here today. Yeah. I'm interested in what makes people tick and why they do what they do. What I see in your films that is similar and that I love about Ken Burns films is the pacing, sort of the slower pacing, how the music works with the visuals. That's the feeling that I'm talking about that's similar. Your films are very visually polished and rhythmically tight. I'm wondering how you work with your DP and your editor. Are you a director that shows up with a specific, you know, visual reference, cuts in your head, or do you prefer to give everybody a lot of room to explore? Or like, who do you take with you? Are you the director and you have everything in your head and you are the editor and you just take some other people to help you do stuff?
Yeah, well, in that regard, I always like it to be a collaborative art, right? It is a collaborative art in what we do. But that being said, I always look for opinions from whoever, but ultimately the final say has to be on my end. But I don't want anybody to ever not come to me with an idea, because you never know what you could be giving up. And so, but when we do go out and we do shoot, if we have three cameras or four cameras or whatever it is, or, you know, you're dealing with a drone or you're dealing with this, whatever, I can't be in every single place sometimes. Right. So sometimes you have to do a little bit of everything of what you just said. Sometimes you can be right there and say, no, this is what I want. Or you got to pick, like, okay, what's important right now? Because you got an hour here and I got a camera over there, a camera over there, and he's there. What do I want? So it's a fast moving process. Sometimes you could be sitting around not doing anything for months, but once you get there, you gotta go. And then, sure, and with the editor, it's the same thing. You know, I like to also give the editor their time to learn the material and see what they come up with, and then bounce ideas off of that. And again, if I don't like it, then I will definitely say it. But there's sometimes that I'll say things that they then put really into a visual sense for me. And I look at it, I'm like, I don't know what I was thinking. So it works both ways. And I do want somebody to tell me if they don't like it, but tell me why you don't like it. Yeah. And then I'll make a decision.
I love that. That's kind of the way I am too. One of the things that really struck me as I was prepping for this interview is that you've done everything right. You know, you've had a successful theater documentary, an HBO film, a CNN acquisition, incredible access to powerful people. And yet, like so many of us, you've still had projects that were, I mean, I'm assuming harder to place than it would be, like not quickly selling to different things, and things have changed. So how, as an artist and a business person right now, as you're trying to sell this film or, you know, other ones that you've got in the works, how, and you know, what would you say to filmmakers as they're pouring their hearts into these great works and still struggling to try to get something sold to streamers or things like that?
So the number one thing I think, and I live by this as well, is you do what you believe in. Because you've got to be the one that spends either the year, two, or three living and breathing the project. And in order to do that, you have to like what you're doing. Otherwise, I believe that the end result will reflect your feeling on what you're doing. You know, what's the saying? That they always say a piece of you comes out in your movie. And I didn't understand that until I went through it. And I believe in that. What I do is, obviously, that we fund this ourselves carefully. We do it so that we can make the project where nobody is telling us what to do. But there's the good and the bad. The good and the bad is I can go off and make what I want. But the bad is, at the end of the day, I have to still go out and try to sell it. Right. I've given up the idea that this, you're going to get a big agent and all those things. And it's just not going to happen, because documentaries in themselves don't make a lot of money to where it would be profitable for a William Morris type company, right? Because they're dealing with big packages and this, that, and the other. And so if you're going to do it, you got to do it. But, and if you're going to take 2 or 3 years to do it, the landscape can change, right? So whatever you think is good, like, you know, if you're making a movie about a certain thing and then, like, say a Me Too movement comes out, well, that nobody may want to look at your movie, depending on what it is or who's in the Oval Office this go. So there are some things that are out of your hand that you can never plan on. But circumstances in the world may dictate if somebody's willing to look or not look at somebody's movie. So I just try to make it on what I can do. And when I started in 2007 or 2008, you know, the best place to go for a documentary was theatrical when that was still going on. And then if you went straight to DVD, you were considered a failure. And then when I got into 41, the top of the heap then was really HBO with Sheila Nevins. And then as streaming was started, if you went straight to streaming, because remember Netflix had that the red envelope for independent filmmakers, paid for a little bit of money to help build their library, then you were considered a failure. Mm-hmm. So now, if you look at HBO, I mean, look, my opinion, but HBO is different now, right? Because of the companies that have bought this and bought that. So they look for different things. And now you are successful if you go streaming, because that's really, where else are you going to go these days? Theatricals may or may not happen. And if they do, generally you do it because they're going for Oscar consideration to rent LA and New York and play the week or two or whatever the rules are. So I've just kind of picked a lane and stayed in it and not try to worry too much, but it's not easy. I mean, it just is not. You could see the movie and like the movie, that's great, but what we go through, you know this, and nobody will ask you what is your process, right? Or like you get a reviewer and then you get all upset because somebody wrote something about this, that they see your movie for maybe an hour and a half, then want to tear you down without asking the filmmaker, anybody, what did you go through? Asking you, why did you make it like this, right? So they're judging you without understanding anything.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time with sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I don't see a lot to judge here other than a lot of good things. What I see is an industry that is struggling to make space for independent filmmakers. And I see it for independent filmmakers. I think you're very fortunate to be able to make your documentaries on your own dime. I'm not able to do that. I am stuck, you know, halfway with a film that's now looking for finishing funds and I don't have them. And it's a great movie. And, you know, the first film that I did is making money, but it's not making enough money to be able to invest in this next movie. And that's not uncommon.
No, and we go through that too. We do. And I don't want anybody to think like we just have oodles of money over here. Because like you say, it is not easy. You've got to scrutinize everything on the budget. How much is this flight? How much is the one stop? How much is the two stop? You know, can you save money here? How do you save money there? We go through that like anybody, an independent filmmaker. And when you get to finishing, you got to make a deal with somebody. It's like, oh Lord, you know, everything is just a struggle, you know?
It really is. Well, I have a whole bunch of other questions for you, but we unfortunately are running out of time. You have been a fabulous guest. I appreciate your sharing your wisdom with me. We do have one more section I want to get thrown in here. It's everybody's favorite section. We call it DocuView Deja Vu. And what we'd like you to do is share a favorite documentary that you think our audience should watch.
Oh, boy. Can I hold you there for a moment?
Sure.
I literally am blanking on the name of the document. It was the Robert Evans documentary.
You can look it up on IMDb.
Yeah. Okay. I see it and everything, but oh my God. Oh, The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Is that the name of it?
I believe so. I'm going to look that up. Kid Stays in the Picture. Older for sure, but I don't know if you ever saw it.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was 2002. And then, okay.
You like baseball. You like baseball.
Oh, I do.
Where's that seat from?
That is from the Dodgers. Dodgers.
You're a Dodgers fan?
Well, it's LA. What can I say? I mean, you can't see. Can I move the camera for a sec?
I'm in Chicago, so I don't like the Dodgers.
That's okay. I'm going to show you something.
Who is signed?
On that, that was the sort of the famous Dodger infield of Bill Russell, Davey Lopes, Tommy Lasorda, Ron Sain, Steve Harvey.
I have respect. I don't like the Dodgers, but I have respect.
No, that was more that's where my heart is with those players than today's players.
Yeah.
I don't think you can see this, but this is also hanging up there, but you don't see.
He gave you a tie.
Well, actually there you see him. God,
I can't. I don't describe. I see you and he's wearing a tie. I see a picture of a camera.
Yeah. She's taking the picture, but basically when we were coming out with that movie, we were doing a screening
picture of that and text it to me.
Okay. So we were doing a photo shoot, publicity stuff. And so his assistant comes up to me and says, here, he got you a gift. And I said, oh, okay, great. I kind of put it down. He says, no, you don't understand. You got to open that right now. And I said, oh, okay. So I opened it up and it was the tile. And then he says, turn it over. And he said, it was embroidered 41. And he says, President Bush only made two of those and he's wearing the other one right now. And so then we took the pictures with them. And then when he passed, and I had never worn this, and when he had passed away, we were invited to the funeral, but on it, the one that was down in College Station. And USA Today had asked me to write an article on my time with him. And I ended it with telling the story, but I said, there's only one time that I'll wear this tie and I'll never wear it again. And that'll be, I think it was like on Tuesday, because that was his funeral. So I wore it at his funeral and then I put it in this case and then I'll never wear it again.
I mean, that is just so, so special. You know, one of the things that I love about your documentary and what I hate about politics is that you never, until after the presidents leave office, you know, do you ever get to see the people. You know, it's what I feel about Jimmy Carter. Like, Jimmy Carter was so misunderstood. Same about Ford, same about Barack Obama. You know, there was just so much about them that was misunderstood and not really known. And some people, when they were in office, saw that side of them, probably those that knew them before they ran, you know, and they stuck with them through everything. But, you know, the thing about George Bush is he was always the same from the time he was a child told the time that he died. And you can see that in his family, you know, how his parents were and how, you know, through his whole family life and how that thread has woven through that family. It's beautiful. You are so blessed that you had that time with them and how much respect he had for you. Clearly that gift, I think, shows how much he appreciated what you did for him and sharing his story and the respect for his family and his work.
He wrote me a letter after, and you know, I'll never say what he wrote, but it was pretty special, you know, and he didn't have to do that. I don't do these things for them to, you know, praise or not praise or whatever it is. I do it because it's what I want to do. And I like the subject, right? But then the personal stuff comes along with it. And those are the moments that are the most fulfilling when you go through this whole process.
I would agree. I just came back from being in New Orleans with a veteran that was in my film, and he's 102, Bauer. And he's shocked when I told him this, but I've now been with him since he was 95. And he just can't believe that. He'll be 103 in May. So it'll be 8 years that we've been friends. And now his family is like my family. And he invited me to New Orleans to be with him. And we just have become so close. And he'll say, we're getting our message out. So his message has become our message. And it's such, I feel so honored. I've learned so much from him. And, you know, in a sense, when I was watching your movie, that, you know, George Bush is a veteran. And you can see that that runs through him, through and through, that veteran mindset of what he did for his country and what it meant to fight for his country and his feelings of when the country was attacked. And when you've spent any time with our veterans from that time period, it changed them. And that is just what I love, spending time with these people that have lived through that time period, because it touches me and is imprinted on me. And I just have such respect. And so you
have such a they have such a different perspective on life.
Yes.
How things should go. And you know, if you ever see a president in waiting.
I'm next. That's next. I'm going to watch it next.
But I've got, imagine this, right? So I have four pairings of presidents and vice presidents that I'm putting into this movie to not really talk about politics, right? But the relationship between a president and vice president. But, and at the end of the day, people will ask me, they're like, oh, well, who's your favorite? Right. And I'm like, well, you know, it's kind of like your kids. You kind of like each one for different reasons. And or somebody wants to bitch and moan, you got Cheney, or on the other side of it, you interviewed Clinton. It's like, listen, here's what I say. If you were in a bar with any one of these guys and you didn't know their name and you just sat down and had a beer with them, you'd like them.
Yeah.
But it gets all filtered down through media and all that crap. And then you never get to understand or learn about the person.
Well, I think in this time where you have a different president and all of them have come together to sort of stand in a different way, in a different light, casting a different light in the presidency and against, you know, and for America in a different light, you see them all differently. I mean, they are all together and unified and laughing. And, you know, they're, you know, just you can see George Bush and Michelle Obama are close and you just see the friendships there. And you can tell there's camaraderie and they really are different people, I think, when they were younger, but you can see a different side of them. And yeah, I see what you're talking about. You have been very blessed to have had those opportunities with those people and to know them for sure.
And I humbly know that. How we've been able to do that, I don't know. I mean, I still wonder how we got it, but yeah,
you're
no, I mean,
itself.
In my perspective has changed too, you know, because of getting to spend time with these guys or anything. It's just, you realize really what's important and what's not. And
for sure.
Yeah. So sorry for the lore.
Okay. That's all right. Now we are going to go into everybody's favorite section, DocuView Deja Vu. All right. Tell us what documentary you want to share with our audience that you think everybody should see.
Okay, so I'm going to pick an older one, which was called The Kid Stays in the Picture. And it was Robert Evans. He's not in it, but his voice is in it. And the way they shot it, it was very, the way they used the camera for the documentary, the way they used the colors, it was more of using film tools in a time when I don't think really documentaries were coming across as more of a film look. And it was just different. The way they created, I believe, the way they used the photos, there was a process in which even today they call it the kid stays in the picture effect. So that would be my selection, because that one has generally stuck with me for well, you know, 23 years than most. So
all right.
That's my selection.
That's interesting. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that recommendation. And thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your experience with us. It's been lovely getting to know you. Thank you for making your films known to our audience. I'm just super excited that I've now discovered them and just lovely to meet you. I've been touched by your work and learned a few things myself. So I do hope that you'll come back when your next picture is ready. And I wish you all the best with this. I will tell you, your experience with Virgil Films is going to be top notch. I have just loved my relationship with them. So you will be blessed.
Well, thanks. It's been wonderful. I appreciate the time.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody. Hey, everybody. This podcast is brought to you by Documentary First Productions, and we need your support so that we can keep preserving history. If you could go over and grab some merch or watch our films at documentaryfirst.com, you'll help us keep making awesome documentaries and sharing the stories that matter, and also bring amazing filmmakers and their wonderful films to the world. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you for visiting documentaryfirst.com.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.